Kids Comics.
And here are your hosts, Michael and Andrew Leyland.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome back to the best reunion that has ever happened in the history of ever.
Ever.
Since Noel and Liam said they were getting back together. I'm jumping the gun, though.
Yeah. Because the problem, you know, it was a greatest hits announcement.
It was an announcement that it's the 30th anniversary of Definitely Maybe.
Yeah.
As far as we are concerned, there is a big hubbub that Oasis are going to announce that they're back together. As far as you're concerned, that's old news.
Yeah.
But that's the way it goes when you've got to record this far in advance. Welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. He is Michael Leyland.
And he is Andrew Leyland.
And we're here to talk about comics.
Yeah.
That's essentially what the show is. It's not reinventing the wheel.
The wheel is perfectly fine.
The wheel is perfectly fine. Fire has been discovered. All we are doing is burning that wheel.
Right.
By making this podcast where we just talk about comics. Yeah. And viewership has been going up. Is it viewership when it's audio?
Is it not listenership?
Listenership, thank you very much, has been going up. That's nice. And we want to throw a shout out to Dan Doherty, who bought us a coffee.
Throw away a shout out.
I'm going to throw out a shout out, mate.
I've only ever shouted once and I wouldn't want to do it again.
Nah, man, I'm sitting in my chair. So if you get that, you're on TikTok too much. Dan Doherty bought us a coffee.
Very nice.
So the next time
we
go out together,
we can share half a coffee.
No, he gave us a fiver.
Right, that's probably half a coffee.
Is that two coffees? No, if we go to Greg's,
that will buy
us two coffees. Because coffee in Greg's is only £2.50.
And if we go at the right time, we can get a coffee each and a croissant each.
Absolutely, or a cruller.
Or a what?
One of them big phallic things that's covered with white stuff. I don't know what the proper name is. But they come in a two-pack, man. They come in a two-pack and they're very sugary and bad for you. Oh, so tasty. Michael's already lost the plot. Anyway, so thank you very much. If you want to be like Dan and purchase a coffee for us, which I think is better than Patreon.
It's not asking for
a regular commitment.
Yeah.
If you want to be like Dan and buy us a coffee, the instructions are in the end tag and it is very much appreciated in these credit crunch times. These cost of greed times. That somebody has given us some money for a coffee. So that's very kind. So next time we go somewhere together, I'll get you Greg's coffee.
Okay.
Which are better than Starbucks.
They're not bad, actually.
For what they are, perfectly cromulent coffees in many ways. Anyway, we'll kick off with an email, and then we'll go into Clone Saga Chronicles, and then we may do some more emails, because Jack Kirby, a lot of responses.
A lot of people,
People love the Kirby. And why not? Why would you not love the Kirby? And then we'll tell you what we're covering today. But as Michael points out every time I say this, trying to build up some level of suspense.
they already know.
Hitchcockian way. I've already put the graphic up.
Cockian is correct.
and done the little blurb saying in today's episode, Michael and Andrew do this. So our first email today, tonight, tomorrow and always is from Dan Dickholtz. And it's not in there, it's in there. And it's about the Kirby stuff. Dan Dickholtz is a published author.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, he's had a book published and everything. Right. He sent me a copy, I reviewed it on Palace.
Very nice.
It's the one about alternate realities.
Does that make us slightly more respected now?
Yes, because we are dealing with published authors. So we're very darling. We're part of that set, darling.
We've moved up.
We have? Well, it wasn't difficult, let's be honest. Bar wasn't high. anyway, just listen to the latest Hey Kids Comics, says Dan. And a few things came to mind, especially since I'm old enough that I actually bought some of these titles off the newsstands. I have to admit, whilst I liked the issues of Omar that I got, I also didn't go out of my way to seek out the next installment. Even as the years passed, I always liked checking out the occasional appearances. The DC Comics Presents drawn by George Perez is a standout, as is the Burn miniseries. We should cover the Burn miniseries.
Okay.
Because I've not read that since I bought it back when it came out, which was like, ooh. It was around the time he was doing Superman. So that's late 80s, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind doing that. We've done the DC Comics Presents. We did it back in Hey Kids. The early years. I wasn't quite as decrepit as I am now. and you were a mere strapling. We covered that issue of DC Comics Presents. And it is indeed very, very fantastic. Since you kept mentioning Command-D. Well, there was an in-joke there. Because Michael, as a kid, didn't get Command-D.
It was when... it's probably recorded. It was in the Final Crisis episode.
Yeah, it was on the earth.
You can literally hear the
penny in the earth
turn, yeah.
And literally hear it hit the floor.
Wait, so Commandy was made in Command D. Command D.
And you actually did that in real time. And it's one of our finest podcasting moments, it has to be said. It's interesting to note, continues Dan, that whilst Kirby seemed to view his non-Fourth World projects of the era as being unrelated to each other, those who took over after Kirby had other ideas. Commandy was revealed to be a descendant of OMAC, and both Commandy and OMAC were part of the same future history that included the post-World War II Atomic Knight and Hercules Unbound, the latter of which had a very specific OMAC callback. All of that was spelt out by Paul Levitt in an article in the Old Company fanzine Amazing World of DC Comics, and I'll get you a copy of the piece. And he did. He sent us a link to that, and it's an interesting article. Nice. I enjoyed reading it. I should have sent it you. If I was a professional podcaster,
yeah, well,
I would have prepared you for this, but I didn't. Because I'm not. Nevertheless, I still picked up a few issues past the first one, and they were fun. There was a two-parter in which Kirby goes full-on biblical apocalypse, with Crow and the Deviants deliberately coming on as demons to bring a fearful modern humanity to its knees. There was also an annual that brought in various historical figures like Jack the Ripper. So that's the Eternals.
Okay.
As for 2001, since it seems like you guys only looked at the Treasury adaptation in the first issue, I think you might have been selling it a little short. If you look at the first 7 regular issues, you'll see that it's one arc that expands on the film, allowing more to happen in each era. In the first issue, it's weighted more towards the caveman beast killer, whose time comes after the hominids of the film. And then we get the two-parter that is weighted more on this Iron Age Conan-esque era. The next 3 issues move us into the future, with the latter 2 taking us into 2040, which isn't that far away. Then we get issue 7, which starts with an astronaut being transformed into a star child who then takes off across the universe to have an adventure on another world. Essentially, it's like a sequel if we simply picked up at the moment the movie had ended. Who knew that Clark would later write 2010 and its sequels? The next 3 issues make up the big introduction of Mr. Machine. It's Mr. Machine Man, isn't it? Not Mr. Machine?
Machine Man.
Yeah, I think it's Machine Man. I think there may be a mix-up of Mr. Miracle and Machine Man going on there. It would later be known as Machine Man. All right, hey. So he was called Mr. Machine originally. I did not
All
know
you
that.
Have to do is
if
read
you
ahead.
Keep reading, it's like watching a movie where the plot unspools.
Answers, yeah.
So don't jump on other people's emails is the lesson of this particular episode. My feeling is that at this point, Kirby was simply going to use 2001 as an anthology title to introduce assorted concepts, with the monolith only popping up to justify the license and be the one continuing element. Instead, the book was cancelled, but we got Kirby working on a regular Machine Man title. Well, thank you, Dan. That was quite interesting. And the link, I'll send you the link. Because it did make for interesting reading. We have other emails to get to, which we will do as we go through the show, because we don't actually do a specific email what's it anymore, do we? Okay, before we get cracking with today's topic, it is Clone Saga Chronicles.
This is what people come in
this
for.
This is what people show up for.
Yeah.
I genuinely believe that. They're going to be very, very disappointed today.
Oh, have we moved on to a different omnibus?
No. We're on the same omnibus and I've read one issue.
Oh, okay, that's a bit...
Yeah, because I've been very busy. Obviously, what we're covering this month was a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
I've obviously been on holiday, where I didn't do any notes or anything like that, because I was relaxing. Well, yeah, but, you know, also. And also, you know, life gets in the way, man. And there's only so many of these massive omnibuses you can read. I've got one in each hand, as it is.
You buy one every week.
Yeah, so. Well, I try to. So the only issue I've read this time, we've got rid of all the Scarlet Spider nonsense, for the most part, and we actually launch with the first issue of Sensational Spider-Man by Dan Jurgens and Klaus Janson. And do you know what?
What?
Breath of fresh air.
Right, okay.
Absolutely total breath of fresh air. It really felt like this issue, they had a remit. Ben Reilly is now Spider-Man.
Yeah.
They know where they're going and what they're doing. In the course of this issue, he introduces a number of new supporting characters.
Right.
He sets up Ben Reilly's new job. He's basically Gunther.
Okay.
From Friends, working in a coffee shop.
Right.
So, sadly, it is not the coffee bean. If you remember in the 60s comics, him and Gwen and Harry and that lot used to hang out in the coffee bean.
Mm.
Whereas this is, if I can find the right page, the coffee something or other. This is fantastic. The Daily Grind.
Right.
You see what they did there?
Yeah.
It would have been cool if it was the Coffee Bean under new ownership. That would have been a nice callback. But he introduces those characters, the character who leads the Coffee Bean and her son, and Desiree Winthrop, who seems to be Mary Jane, but slightly more vacuous. And he introduces a character called Jessica, who will be very important to Spider-Man's origin. And it's lovely. And it's got great art. And he dyes his hair blonde at the end of it. And I genuinely believe that if they could have found a way of making Ben Reilly Peter Parker, we would still be reading this version of Spider-Man today. So that was a step in the right direction. And I'm very much looking forward to the next two issues before we have another Scarlet Spider miniseries and an issue of New Warriors. Can't wait for that. So, before we carry on, let's have a look at another email. Jack Bond emailed. Is 2001.
2001?
Is 2001 eternally the future that's coming? Kirby is here. Oh, wait. Now, Kirby is over there. Admitted at this point, Kirby is everywhere. A while ago, I found an old comic shop selling a good amount of the Eternals in 2001 for cheap. Not more than $3. I'm going to say 2002 so I can joke that they've given up on selling the title. That's quite funny if you don't butcher it when you read it. DC had just printed collections of the Fourth World in black and white and selected shades of grey. And I was eager to read Kirby's other saga. As DC writers had been using parts of the New Gods, mostly Darkseid, Marvel writers had been refreshing parts of the Eternals, because when you want to go cosmic, a 1,000-foot-tall armoured space god just adds the right touch. It may just be me, but I found the Eternal series less exciting as it went on, with a sense of it losing the story. Well, the story has a beginning, middle and end, whilst the series always has a next issue. I wonder if it was better for the Fourth World books to have been cut short, and whether the latter half of Mr. Miracle would have been much different, even without editorial interference. As for 2001, are you aware that the first half dozen issues ring in the changes on the story in the first one? Well, we are, because we just read that email from Dan. So we are aware of that now. Some person has a prehistoric encounter with a monolith. A direct descendant encounters one in comparable circumstances in the future. This person later passes through the monolith to some idyllic setting and transforms into a star child. I just don't want you to think you brought the same issue twice and wonder why you remembered it differently. They're worth reading, as any Kirby is, but following your suggestion of a one-volume follow-up to the adaptation, I'd combine one of those stories with issue 7, which tells what these cosmic kids were getting up to out in the universe. That is essentially the end of the series. 8, 9 and 10 were a showcase for Mr. Machine, until Marvel got tired of paying for the license and bought him into his own comic titled Machine Man. So he was Machine Man, and he was Mr. Machine, and if I'd have paid any attention whatsoever to what I was doing,
would have known all
that
these things.
Would never have been an issue, would it? Okay. Alright, for today, we are covering Hellblazer by Garth Ennis. Omnibus. Yep, we're going to go through the entire omnibus in 90 minutes.
Wow.
There's a challenge.
That's, yeah.
Isn't it? Art in this magnificent tome by William Simpson, Steve Dillon, John Higgins, Peter Schnesberg, David Lloyd, Mike Hoffman and Glyn Dillon. And covers, as presented in this, are by Glenn Fabre. I'm going to remove the dust jacket because dust jackets annoy me. So let's just chuck that out of the way. And I actually think this looks better without the dust jacket.
Right, yeah.
Because they've reproduced two lovely John Constantine Glenn Fabry covers there, which are better. Yeah, the one on the front with John Constantine in front of the church window with the pen in his hand looks like a paintbrush, but isn't. And a bottle of whiskey in his other hand is... Mum always says that's you.
Right, okay.
If that makes you feel any better.
Grumpy alcoholic.
Yeah, grumpy alcoholic artist. Hellblazer was part of editor Karen Berger's editorial group at DC Comics, along with Sandman and Swamp Thing. Both books launched off the back of a successful poaching of British creators to DC Comics in the mid-1980s. Alan Moore, as part of that Swamp Thing run, created John Constantine, to be drawn by Steve Bissett and John Totliban. He was described as looking like Sting. Fortunately, Sting didn't sue, and was, according to an interview in Rolling Stone, quite flattered to be depicted as a comic book character. DC still got cold feet, though, and have downplayed this similarity in more recent years, including in this very omnibus. In the introduction by, is it editor Stuart Moore? Does the introduction? Yeah.
Right.
He never once says Sting's name.
Okay.
He says, you know who,
right.
Or you know who we're talking about.
Yeah.
And it's... I don't understand that. He's already said he's fine with it. He's already said he's not going to sue him. So
why separate something that's already fine?
Yeah. And something that's common knowledge.
Yeah.
And out there in the ether. John Constantine was a master sorcerer, a master manipulator, and a master orator. One of the finest occult magicians in the world, although one who prefers to use his wits to defeat his various foes, which are mostly demons from hell. A working class hero from Liverpool, Constantine proved so popular that in 1988, Constantine was given his own comic series, Hellblazer. And in 1993, this was one of the first books to be converted into a Vertigo book, the beginning of a new imprint at DC that would be creator-owned and vastly different to the comics DC published normally. Hellblazer fit into Vertigo quite naturally, as it was already a moody and relentlessly dark series, featuring a multi-layered and troubled protagonist who was rarely better than the foes he vanquished, with Constantine building a rep for bringing misfortune on his friends and family. It was unlike any other book being published at the time. After all, as John Lennon once said, a working class hero is something to be. After 40 issues, writer Jamie Delano decided to move on, and editor Stuart Moore cast his net wide for a replacement. The net reeled in young Northern Irish writer Garth Ennis, then only 20 years old, but already building his own rep thanks to a series he wrote for Crisis magazine about the Troubles in Northern Ireland, Troubled Souls and its sequel For a Few Troubles More. Thereafter, he moved to 2000 AD and wrote Judge Dredd before being part of the second wave of creators to up sticks for more lucrative work at DC Comics. This Garth Ennis Hellblazer omnibus covers his entire run from issue 41 through issue 83, skipping only issue 51 as that one wasn't written by Ennis, and the five-issue Son of Man arc he returned for in 2004, as well as other one-shots, specials and short stories. This'll be a whistle-stop tour of a great run of horror books by a great writer at an exciting and unprecedented time in American comics publishing.
Am I correct in believing Constantine's first appearance was in Crisis? He shows up in one or two panels.
No, his first appearance was in Swamp Thing, wasn't it?
No, I know. But wasn't it actually in Crisis? Because Crisis wanted to include, to an extent, every single character. And so he appears in that before he appeared in Swamp Thing, but was already planned to appear in Swamp Thing.
You may be. I honestly don't know. Because we're reading the facsimiles.
Because I know he's in Crisis.
Yes, where he showed up in the issue, yeah, I've just read.
But I swear there was an overlap, and I can't remember if he was first in that or first in Swamp Thing and then in that.
Well, Crisis is obviously 1985.
Yeah.
So does that predate his Swamp Thing stuff?
I don't know.
I don't. You know, we could look it up, but...
Yeah, well, why not?
Yeah. We may as be as misinformed as everyone else on the internet. It was weird because we're both reading the facsimiles for Crisis.
Yeah.
Thoroughly enjoying them. Loving it much more than Secret Wars, but that's just common sense.
Yeah.
But reading Crisis like that, it's so weird to have John Constantine show up in that series, isn't it?
Completely different.
Yeah, if there's anybody who does not belong yeah, amongst the cape and spandex set,
yeah,
it's John Constantine.
Yeah,
so or John Constantine, whichever way you want to say it. You know, I think it's Fog on the Tyne. Oh, mine, but that's just me. You've not read this. You stole all my comics when you left home.
I didn't steal. You gave them to me for safekeeping, and I keep them safe.
Which meant I had to buy this omnibus.
Oh, no. Oh.
Well, I wasn't looking for it,
yeah,
but somehow I found it.
I'm okay.
And therefore, you missed my Live and Let Die quote. Oh, no, it wasn't Live and Let Die, was it? It was Spy Love Me, that, isn't it? I wasn't looking, but somehow I found you. So I found this for like 40, 50% off.
Okay, yeah.
I found it on eBay. So at that price, by Grabthar's Hammer, what a bargain.
Yeah.
So I picked it up, and thus began the gestation of this, where you and I have basically been just ploughing through this, texting each other as we've read each issue.
Yeah.
Over the past month or so. Ennis kicks off his run with Dangerous Habits with art by Will Simpson, which ran through issues 41 through 46. Arguably, Ennis's most famous storyline was adapted, very loosely, into the Hellblazer movie starring Keanu Reeves as John Constantine, as perfect a piece of comic book casting as one could hope for. Looks to camera.
You know, I'm going to be honest. It's not awful.
No, it isn't. Since, you know, getting over ourselves.
Yeah.
One of the main changes between the old version and this one, we're a lot more relaxed about this stuff.
I mean, I had to watch it because
Steve Dillon told you to.
Steve Dillon told me to.
Yeah, the weekend before he died.
Yeah.
So basically, he's dying wish.
I don't like to think that I'm that important, but I do.
You do like to think you're that important. Yeah, we have subsequently... Do you know, I find a more egregious piece of casting.
Right.
Shia LaBeouf as Chaz. That's worse piece of casting.
That's a thing.
And
it?
I don't have a problem with Shia LaBeouf. I think Shia LaBeouf showed a lot of potential in his early roles. So that's more egregious to me. But as a bog-standard supernatural movie...
It's perfectly fine.
It's perfectly fine. If you've got any familiarity with John from the comics, it's woefully miscast.
It's less fine.
Isn't it? Let's be honest. I love Keanu.
Yeah.
I've got all the time in the world for, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back. But he's not John Constantine.
No.
Nowhere. So, but if you can get over that, it's a perfectly fine supernatural horror film.
Yeah.
It's not good, but it's not crap. Basically, this is the Constantine gets cancer arc. For most of its 6 issues, I was quite surprised on this reread that it was John trying anything and everything to cheat the Grim Reaper until he finally realises there's no way out and he won't go out in a battle to the death with a demon. He'll be laid low by a very human disease. And it's only when he stops moping and starts thinking that he comes up with a solution to his no-win scenario. I mean, I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek, but like Captain Kirk, his solution with you was unique. What did you think of Dangerous Habits?
It's quite an interesting one. I feel like it's iconic. It's certainly one of those story arcs that stands out from the whole 300-issue run.
It's very different from the others, isn't it?
It's one of those things where it reads as a mission statement for what Ennis wants to do. It reads as an epilogue for the Delano stuff that came before it. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like it belongs to the rest of it. It kind of stands out. It's very dreary. It's very woe is me. But at the same time, it's this perfect introduction to this character, whilst also not being a decent introduction at the same time. It's a very interesting one to reread, kind of knowing where everything goes. And it's... Yeah, in one hand, it's not a very good jumping on point, but in the other one, it's also an equally good jumping on point. It's this bizarre mix that you can kind of tell that this was Ennis saying what he was going to do with the character, but doesn't exactly know what he wants to do with the character himself.
Yeah, it's very much a mission statement of what Ennis' take on Hellblazers is going to be.
Without being that, because it changed drastically throughout.
Yeah, it's very definitely going to be a more down-to-earth take on the character than what Jamie Delano was doing.
Yeah.
That's readily apparent. It will become more of an emphasis on normal people caught up in extraordinary events as it goes along.
Yeah.
That's not really a part of this, but he's not built up his supporting cast yet.
Yeah.
And Constantine will become a lot more laddie.
Yes.
As befits the time it was written.
Yeah.
And he's much less of an aloof bastard.
Yeah, I think... In the beginning bits, certainly kind of how he was written more, was just he's a bit of a yuppie bastard.
Mm.
Whereas when you get later on, he's your punk kid again. It's kind of like we've remembered that he was a wannabe Sex Pistols punk kid. Yeah. And he's
Mucus membrane.
In his punk band, he's more of a gobshite and that. It's kind of like Ennis has kind of looked at, well, if that's how he started, why isn't he like that? Why is he acting this way? Let's kind of, not necessarily course correct, but this is my interpretation of how a mentally unhinged teenage punk would go.
Mm.
He would, you know, hang out with absolute degenerates. His mates would be pieces of shit. But then what do you do when your main character is supposed to be the biggest piece of shit compared to those? It's an interesting mini course correction within its own story.
Yeah, and Ennis isn't quite Ennis yet.
No.
The dialogue, normally what he's exceptional at,
yeah,
isn't quite there in this first one. It feels clunky and unnatural. If you and me like to read this shit out loud, something your mum constantly
in my head all
the
time,
takes
the
mick out of for me. And in my head, he's got a little bit of a scouse to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's got a little bit of John Lennon. He's not an out-and-out Cockney. No. Because he's from Liverpool.
Yes, yeah.
So there's no reason to believe he ever really lost that Scouse twang.
No. And not when it's such a very clear accent as well.
And he works better as a Scouser.
That's how I read it.
He works better as that slightly charming, but also slightly dangerous Scouse kid that we've all known.
Yeah.
Even if you grow up away from Liverpool, there's always one Scouser in your school.
Yeah.
It's probably more now, but there was always one.
That adds to his character, because that's who he is.
Yeah.
But then...
But you can't read the dialogue in Dangerous Habits with a Scouse accent. It's Cockney.
Because it... I don't know if it's a kind of... This was how books of this time were kind of written, but it reads more like... It's very poetic. It's very more attuned to Gaiman with Sandman.
Mm.
It's very dark poetry kind of vibes, when that's not where the book would end up going. So it's interesting to go back and go, oh, this is a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. And it's good.
Yeah.
I very much enjoyed reading it, but he's a bit of a whiner.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
In these first six issues.
Well, I liked that. He would whine. He always wins.
He was always a bit of a self-important jackass.
So what happens when the self-important jackass who always wins, he never loses, is faced with something as real and inevitable as cancer?
Yep. So it was a good idea. And it isn't just over in this six issues. That thread that he screwed over Lucifer runs through Ennis's entire run.
Yeah. This is essentially Q's trial in the pilot.
Of Star Trek, and the trial was never over.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. He introduces Kit in this story as a romantic interest. She's an Irish artist. She's basically Aisling B. Really, isn't she? Before anyone knew who Aisling B was. And Will Simpson's art is also very rough and quite loose. Go on.
I was going to say, it's strange seeing it in your omnibus, actually, because the omnibus, obviously, it's came out, this year? It's very clean.
I think so.
And the artwork looks interesting. But first off, the artwork is collected within the page, so you've got your bleed and your gutters and that.
Yeah.
With the issues, you don't. And it was quite interesting just seeing how clean this artwork looks in this omnibus compared to the issues that I was reading, where it does feel... messy. It does feel...
Well, it was still newsprint at this point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Vertigo only goes to glossier paper.
Yeah.
When it becomes Vertigo, is that right?
Yeah.
Or just before?
Right. Yeah, kind of. But it's... I don't think I like seeing this artwork in such a clean way. It doesn't suit it.
You like the griminess of the original issue.
That's the Vertigo vibe.
Yeah. Well, Moore says in the introduction, Simpson was not the fastest artist in comics and therefore had to bring in Inkers, too much Hannibal, to help keep the train running on time. Nowhere is this more apparent than issue 46, which has four different Inkers.
Oh, right.
Yeah. To help complete this issue, and that's your Dangerous Habits epilogue, which, you know, it's fine.
Which is quite interesting because, to be polite as possible. It's interesting that he's such a slow artist then, when he's not, let's say, the stronger artist of this book.
No, but at the same time, like you put it in a text message between us both when we were talking about this, he's a quintessential Vertigo artist.
Yes, absolutely.
This is what Vertigo wanted.
Yeah, and it works. It works for the style, but it's one of those things where just because it works doesn't mean it's that good, but it's not bad at the same time. It's just...
Yeah. Well, the epilogue basically has Constantine go back and meet somebody who was also diagnosed with lung cancer.
Yeah.
Who's in hospital because he knows he's not going to survive.
Yeah.
And it's John facing the fact this guy's dying. No amount of sorcery or talking your way out of it is going to help him.
Yeah.
He's dead.
Yeah.
And the issue ends with him dead. And per Ennis, because we've got to tick all the Ennisisms.
The Ennisisms.
The first one that we get from this particular book is a quote from The Pogues.
The Rainy Night in Soho.
Rainy Night in Soho. And the epilogue is the epilogue included in the trades?
Which epilogue?
This Dangerous Habits epilogue.
Well, I'd imagine so.
I don't know, because I've never read the trade paperback, so I don't know. But yeah, it doesn't work without it. So I would imagine that is included in the trade paperbacks.
This run as well introduced me to the Pogues as well, and this song, especially "Rainy Night in Soho," it's genuinely one of my favourite films. Top three films, songs, top three favourite songs because of this run. And I think I mentioned to you, kind of reading through this, it's very, very interesting how much the Pogues influenced the run. Because I listened to a lot of it while I was reading as well. And just so many of those songs, that kind of vibe and Shane McGowan storytelling very much influenced this, that, you know, I'd be half tempted to give Shane McGowan a co-writer's credit, is how much those songs feel very much a part of this world and how this world... It was really interesting, and I liked the use of the songs. But even other songs, like Boys from the County Hell and that other kind of... You can listen to it and go, oh, I can see this fitting in. I can see this being quoted in it. It was really nice.
And we'll carry on to that as well. He'll quote the Pogues quite a lot in Preacher.
Yeah.
One of the issues of Preacher is called And I Built My Dreams Around You,
isn't it?
Which is obviously the most famous Pogues song.
And I like that. I like reading stuff and it using things that introduces you to other things. When it springboards you off into things you never would have looked at otherwise. Yeah.
Well, in the letters pages, didn't he used to do... Or was this a different comic? They used to do what songs they were listening to read the comic, or while they were writing the comic, or stuff like that.
I know Yannick Paquette did a playlist for every issue of Swamp Thing.
And they did a playlist for every issue of the Enfield Town Massacre as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure Ennis used to do what I'm listening to this month, what I'm watching, the letters pages.
Right.
And he'd say what films he'd been watching, what books he'd been reading.
He did that a bit in Preacher.
Was that Preacher?
Because he would quote a film, and the competition was you could win a script if you guessed it.
Yeah, all right, so maybe I'm mixing that up with Preacher, but I did remember that he did that. Issues 47 and 48 are The Pub Where I Was Born. Laura and Freddie run the Northampton Boozer in Camden. It's a quaint old place, a proper pub from a time before Wetherspoons came along and corporatised the pub, making them generic and homogenous. Freddie died a few years ago, but his ghost stayed with Laura until someone bought them out and wanted the land for a new gym. Tonight, the Northampton will be burned to the ground for the insurance money, and the new owners don't care if Laura goes up with it. An early example of more of Ennis's obsessions, real people, real ale, supernatural horror, and the quest for the perfect piss-up. John is nearly 40 here, because he's one of the few characters aging, or did age in real time,
yeah.
Until the Vertigo version of this character came to an end. And then they've rebooted him, and he's younger, and I'm not as interested in him. But having him behave like he's still 20 here, do you not get a little bit of an Arrested Development vibe?
I like it.
Did you?
Yeah, it's one of my favourite... I love a lot of things that Ennis does. And one of the things that Ennis does really well is drink.
Yeah.
Most of the times you see alcohol or whatever depicted in media, it's always a bad thing that does bad things to people and turns them into assholes. You know, Buffy being a prime example. Mm. Alcohol is always bad.
Be a bad. Tree pretty.
The thing that Ennis gets, though, is that... You know, it's
for most people, it's just a night out.
It's just a night out, and it's your mates. It's the chatting. It's, yeah, you don't. You know, it's
most people don't turn into raging alcoholics.
Well, it's. I mean, is it a British thing as well? We view drink very differently to, say, America, for example. And so, whenever
and France,
Whenever Ennis does drink, it's always your mates, and he does his best. Some of Ennis's best dialogue comes from just talking heads around a bar table.
Which is a lot of this issue where John's cheating at cards.
And so I really like this story because he basically just does a bunch of blokes hanging out in this pub. What does this pub mean to these people?
I love this one.
Yeah.
I think this two-part story is really... It really underlines... One of the things that people who don't like him, don't like Garth Ennis's work, don't get, that under the horror and under the black humour and
people.
Under the grossness, he's actually a really sweet writer.
Yeah.
The relationship here between Laura and Freddie, even after death, is just so touching and sweet.
Yeah.
And I love this two-parter. I think it's really good. It's a lovely story about people and place. And it's just as relevant now, how you're losing a lot of our culture and personality as everything just becomes homogenised.
Yeah.
And the gentrification of our high streets, as it evolves, it used to be full of places like this. Unique pubs, unique shops.
Yeah.
Unique places to go that you perhaps couldn't go in anywhere else.
Yeah.
They were run by mum and dad
in
that shop, and there wasn't another one in another town.
And... What are you now, if not a Wetherspoons or...
Yeah, a Wetherspoons, a Starbucks, TK Maxx,
yeah.
Primark. Everything's the same. Normally in exactly the same order.
Yeah.
And more you start to cherish going to places where little towns are still little towns. And there's no corporatisation there at all. They fought it. There's no McDonald's. Yeah. There's no Kentucky. Because a lot of that speed is being eroded.
Yeah.
And you can argue whether it's a good or bad thing. I think it's a bad thing. What's going to make you travel around if everywhere's the same?
Yeah. Well, we get up into Heartland and they're discussing where do they want to go next. You know, it's just, let's go Spoons. Let's go Spoons. Mm. And I don't know if it's the same as around here, but near where we live, there's just a 5 mile radius of just empty pubs just standing there, boarded up. And then your Spoons is always busy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm biased.
I hate Wetherspoons.
I'm biased. I don't like Wetherspoons at all.
But we're not going to go into why.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, is it not just boring to just, that's it, that's all there is?
And same menu.
Every Wetherspoons is, it's perfect.
Same carpet.
It's perfect for a day after gig. I recently went watching Jamie T and drank a heroic amount, and I know that if I go to the Wetherspoons the next day, that breakfast, regardless of where I am in the country, is going to be the same. And there is a comfort in that, admittedly. But it's also so boring to just think that no matter where you are in the country, your boozer is going to be the same.
Yeah. I mean, I don't go to Wetherspoons at all anymore and refuse to give that man my money. But it's a lovely story. It's a really touching story. With respect, god-awful artwork.
Yeah.
This is not a good art issue. And it's not Will Simpson. This has got a guest penciler. It's got Mike Hoffman and Stan Woke as the penciler and inker on part two. And it's just not good. At all. The colours don't help.
Mm.
The colouring's not great. And this is a prime example of when a comic has a really great story that is ever so slightly spoiled by the fact that the art is not up to par.
Yeah.
John reasons it through, and the ghosts of Laura and Freddy at the end were the idea that they won't be punished for their vengeance. Because he's arguing, if you kill this guy, you're going to go to hell.
Yeah.
And if you don't, they'll turn a blind eye to what you've done so far, because it was vengeance and God's okay with that.
Yeah.
But I want you two to move on to heaven.
Yeah.
And he convinces them to go on to heaven.
It's that idea of how far do you go with revenge or something like that before it changes who you are.
Yeah.
And that just realization of, if you stop now, you'll still be okay and still be who you are. This will still be worth it.
And if you can get over the fact that the art, especially in the second part, is dreadful, it's just a lovely little touching story that points again towards his development as a writer.
Yeah.
That the human equation is always in there. And I think that a couple of times people have tried on social media to get Ennis cancelled. And it never works because, A, he's not on social media in any form whatsoever. So you've got no evidence of him saying something stupid unless you actually, read the comics, which 90% of these people haven't.
Yeah, well, it's also a case of it's very easy and difficult because, as we've discussed several times before, if you pick up any Garth Ennis comic, you were either going to get the single best thing you've ever read or the single worst thing you've ever read. And there is no in-between.
There's not a lot of middle ground, no. When he's on fire,
he's
the best writer in comics. I genuinely believe that.
Yeah.
I'm genuinely on the Ennis train for the most part. And also, there's a masculinity to his writing as well that you don't get with a lot of writers who write this kind of thing.
Right.
And he was addressing toxic masculinity before it was a thing.
Yeah.
And that's another thing that the cancelling people don't understand, that all those things you talk about, Ennis has already addressed them in his stories, probably before you were born.
And also the kind of argument is, just because it is depicted does not mean that it is...
Because he actually does put that in a Preacher Letters page, doesn't he?
Right.
We may not be the most politically correct around these parts, but we ain't no white supremacists either. So take that bollocks elsewhere. He actually says that in a Letters page.
We'll get to it later on. Ennis is very clear on his political stance.
Yes. Oh, yeah, he doesn't hide that.
No.
Under a bushel. Lord of the Dance is issue 49, another early standout. Notable for being Steve Dillon's first issue albeit only in a guest artist capacity. Mm-hmm. A lovely little Christmas story.
Love this issue, yeah.
Yeah, love this issue. Constantine comes across the person the Lord of the Dance hymn was originally written about before it was corrupted by the church for their own ends. He's an ever so depressed spirit, and it's up to Constantine to show him the true meaning of Christmas. Getting pissed with your mates.
Yep. This, I think I picked this to cover on the show before.
Yeah, because you got this signed, didn't you?
Yes, and it's just such a lovely little story that ticks a lot of my boxes. I love biblical history. Mm-hmm. I love stories where it's just about a little piss up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the spirit and that camaraderie of drinking together, of being mates. And again, Ennis lets this shine, but he gives it weight. You know, he's not just doing a story about a piss up, he's doing the power of that, the power of the celebration.
Yeah.
And how, you know, he's not specifically saying religion bad, he's just saying this is the different interpretations, this is how your beliefs can affect that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, what it should just be about is being with people.
Yeah. See, I didn't get the religion is bad aspect of it so much as I got that its theme was the powers that be will happily spoil any fun you have. You only have to look, even on a micro level, the minute a massive corporation gets involved with something that was once good and little, it ruins it. Yeah. Elon Musk with Twitter, Amazon with Comixology, and the list can go on onto bigger and bigger and bigger things.
Well, even more so about the kind of power of censorship. Just because you've censored one little thing, what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah, the stories have been changed and altered and censored through these by different people with different agendas. The other thing I love about this is it's a non-sappy Christmas story.
Yeah.
It's great.
It also...
It's a great issue. Kit really is, what's that, Manic Dream Pixie Girl?
I love Kit. I remember her being in it more. I was quite interested this time that she's burly in it.
I agree with you entirely. She's not that she's burly in it. It felt that she was in it a lot more than she is.
Yeah.
When she's in it, she's in it.
Also lovely as well is we get to the end of this and those two guys are very definitely Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. That is Steve Dillon though.
Right, okay.
Or as he was anyway.
Yeah, at that point. Yeah, it's a lovely little Christmas issue. And, you know, it ends with a bang. Issue 50 is double-sized and sees the return of Will Simpson on art for Remarkable Lives, which has Constantine in contemplative mood, reflecting not only on his own life, but that of the Lord of the Vampires. The history of the Vampire Lord and Constantine's backstory are interesting, but I felt this was a bit of a lesser entry.
Yeah, I didn't really dig this one, because it just felt like a lot of dialogue, and I didn't care about it. Like, it felt like there was no point to it.
Well, he's introducing the Lord of the Vampires because later on the Lord of the Vampires plays a part in the story.
For two issues.
Yes, but it's quite an important two issues.
Yeah. It just kind of felt like, especially for an issue 50 double-sized anniversary one, I didn't get much from this. What was the Lord of the Vampires' reason for bringing John out? Oh, to have him be a spy? But like, it just didn't... This is only retroactively better by those two issues later on.
Yes, it's more important the further you go into the story. But likewise, I mean, I've just said this was a lesser entry for me. I wasn't... The Lord of the Vampires is written as a very over-the-top, campy villain, despite his evil.
Yeah.
And I'm just reminded of, again, that bit in Buffy where the master goes, too much. Yeah. And it feels like he's not got the self-awareness to do the too much bit.
It's kind of like he's kind of slagging off and taking the piss out of the whole vampire trope, but without the self-awareness.
Yeah, because this will have been the time that Into the Vampire was becoming massive, even though the books were already, a decade old at this point?
Yeah.
Something like that. I do love his line about, I'm fascinated by the fact I look like James Dean.
Yeah.
Before anyone knew who James Dean was. I thought that was quite funny. But it's not great.
It also kind of brought up, for me anyway, and obviously you wouldn't have got this at the time contextually, but having Steve Dillon come on to be the guest artist and then go back to Simpson, I was kind of like, at this point, I just wanted more Steve Dillon and I was just waiting for Dillon to come back to the book proper.
Yeah. Yeah, issue 51 isn't by Ennis. Who was that by?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I know it's a
fill-in issue,
isn't it? It's a Sean Phillips issue. It's a great issue.
But obviously, Ennis didn't write it, so he's not here. But issue 52 through 55 are one of Ennis's most controversial stories, Royal Blood, which also saw the arrival of Glenn Fabry on the covers.
Yes.
So the pieces are starting to come together. Yeah. I don't really rate Royal Blood as highly as other stories. Sure, it's edgy to portray the royal family as blood-sucking demons. Get the metaphor, kids? But the revelation that the demon possessing our then-future monarch is Jack the Ripper was old when Star Trek did it in 1967.
It was a bit groan-worthy, and it's just, this is where you get to see the edgy Ennis come out a bit more.
Yeah. It's suitably gory, and Ennis gets to portray all of Westminster as either feckless or selfish or both, which isn't that far from the truth. But the targets, they're a bit obvious.
Yeah.
Did you not think? The ending's pretty good, as Constantine gets his revenge on the man who caused all of this. And let's be honest, Ennis was pretty much on the money regarding Prince Andrew. But mostly, it's edgy for the sake of being edgy. Look how edgy I'm being.
Yeah.
I'm accusing the royal family of being this. And I'm not really going to disguise the art too much, because look at the size of those ears.
Yeah.
And it's fine for what it is. I mean, you're not going to find too many royalists here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I just felt it was a bit.
Especially with all the kind of, oh, we're doing this plot twist now. It's like, I just kind of felt myself just groaning every time. Like, oh, of course he was Jack the Ripper. Of course. Why not?
Yeah, it's not great, we don't think. Issue 56, The Diary of Danny Drake, had art by David Lloyd of V for Vendetta. And it's a creepy little one-shot about a man haunted by his diary that becomes a whole lot darker when John discovers the truth. I liked this one.
Yeah.
Good one and done.
It's really good as well, because I think this is the strengths of Ennis's books.
Yeah.
Just the little bits.
Yeah.
You know, we've just had, what was it, 5-6 issue story arc?
Yeah, the Royal Blood thing.
Wasn't that great? And then you do a Vampire Monster of the Week episode. We're done. Sorted. Yeah. It's great.
And the twist of this one.
Yes.
I really like the twist in this one. So that was... that was a good little done-in one.
It did click to me afterwards. It's the episode of South Park where Cartman pretends to have Tourette's, and then he actually starts getting Tourette's.
Oh, dear.
Because he's keeping all these secrets,
and
then he keeps saying these secrets out loud, the more secrets that he has.
Yes.
It's
issues 57 and 58 sees John and Chaz investigate when a shady private company are digging up corpses and using them to test their weapons. Mortal Clay sees Ennis beautifully contrast the lives the people led when they were alive with the hideous fate that their mortal bodies undergo at the hands of people who are just utter scum.
Yeah.
The kinds of people you want John to really tear into. We're fully on board when John sends these bastards to hell.
It's interesting, because when I was rereading it, there's very little payoff. There's no real explanation as to why this guy's doing this. But then he's just a twat. It's literally like that. Sometimes it's just a case of there is no grand scheme monologue. Some people are just scumbags.
It's that episode of X-Files where there is no X-File, it's people.
Yeah.
It's that episode of Supernatural through the entire episode. Dean's looking for a reason these people are doing this.
And they just do.
And at the end of it, it's because they're human.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, he's like... oh, I hate humans. It's that. It's Torchwood. Torchwood did it as well.
Yeah.
Exactly the same story.
It has got the great bit. One of my favourite moments from this entire run is when John is running down the hill to beat up those guys. And he loses balance, so he has to put it all that weight into the punch to steady himself. And then he has to remind himself, he's not very good at fighting.
No, he's at it.
He's just a bloke. And it's really nice because you read comics and it's all about that kind of escapism, and most of it, especially DC stuff, is your superheroes. So to have this guy who's just a bloke go, why am I doing this? I'm shit at fighting. Yeah. I'm going to get my ass handed to him.
Every time he gets into any kind of fisticuffs, he loses. His ass handed to him. Which is quite funny.
Which explains why he's so charming and why he uses his wit all the time. Because he can't fight.
Because he can't fight. Issue 59 kicks off a three-part story that will ultimately be very, very important to the overall arc. Chantinelle, a demon, and Tacky, an angel of the Lord, fall in love, and Chantinelle falls pregnant, a union that will not be allowed or approved by Lucifer. John helps Ellie cover it all up, but Tally is killed and the child taken by Heaven. Ellie owes John a favour for this act, in which he carves a sigil into her soul so that Lucifer can never find her. In return, John will return into New York to ask for help in his final confrontation with Lucifer. This story is quite horrific in tone, and Hellblazer was very good at playing with the idea that Heaven and Hell are like any factions in a war. They're not that different from each other, and they clearly inspired a similar storyline in the TV series Supernatural and Preacher. Pretty much the gestation of Preacher is these
three
issues. And Supernatural owes an awful lot to this. Not just from what Cass Dress is like, but that whole idea of heaven not necessarily being the good guy.
Yeah.
And hell not necessarily always being as bad as it's painted out.
I like the... I was kind of interested to see how this kind of reads now as well, because this little mini, especially, there's a lot of crossover with some of the other Vertigo books at the time. Sandman is mentioned specifically when Morpheus goes into hell and drives out the demons there.
Yeah.
That's mentioned here. That happened. So I was quite interested to see how this read separately when it so specifically mentions the other Vertigo books of the time.
It's interesting that they tried to maintain some semblance of continuity with the other Vertigo books and his previous appearances in Swamp Thing, even though you know for a fact that any... can't give a rat's ass about any of that stuff. Yeah. I don't know that he even read Sandman.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really seem like his bag, does it? We've mentioned that Will Simpson came back for that particular arc. The Mortal Clay art was drawn by Steve Dillon. End of the line, issue 62, seems Steve Dillon finally come on board as regular artist.
And this for me, even though we're actually halfway through the run, more or less, but this for me is where it just picks up steam. Suddenly, the gang is together and it's just firing on all cylinders.
Yeah. We're 500 pages into this omnibus and it finally gets to the stuff that you wrote. It's like, you know what it's like?
Yeah.
Go with this comparison.
Okay.
The $6 million man. Right. For the first 2.5 seasons, you don't get...
Okay, yeah.
You don't get that. That sound effect is not used in conjunction with Bionics.
Right.
But you remember it as always being there.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this. I would have swore blind Ennis came on board with Dillon much earlier than this. Like, I remember Dangerous Habits was Will Simpson.
Yeah.
But I would swear that Dillon came on earlier.
It's been weird. So it was the same for you. Because when I was reading this quite recently, so much, I remember so much of it, but I remember so much of it differently as well.
Yes. And every time Dillon showed up doing a fill-in, he was like, all right, so Dillon's coming on board now. And then you'd get to the end of that story, like, oh no, Will Simpson's back.
And it's not to dump on Will Simpson.
No.
It is what it is. But for me especially, this is when it starts firing on all cylinders, and this is when it picks up steam, and we're running now.
This is when the Bionic sound effect is there every week.
Yeah.
When once Dillon comes on board, you've got Ennis, you've got Fabry.
You've got Ennis, who now has taken ownership of this
book. Yes, you've got Ennis being Ennis.
Yeah.
Over the past 500 pages, you've watched him becoming.
Yeah.
And he's now Garth Ennis.
Yes.
For good and ill,
he
is now Garth Ennis. Mostly good.
Yeah.
From this point onwards. And Fabry was doing the covers.
Yeah.
And Dillon is now the final piece of that puzzle.
Yeah.
And this is what you remember it being.
This is almost like the testing ground for what would end up being Preacher.
Oh, absolutely. This is them building those blocks.
Yeah.
So that when they get to Preacher, they've got a house to live in.
Which is probably why when Heartland came out, it says on the cover, from the creators of Preacher.
Yeah, not the creators of Hellblazer. Issue 62... sees, as we've said, Dillon come on board, and John takes Kit to Liverpool to see his sister Cheryl and his niece Gemma, who is dabbling in the dark arts. John sets about setting her straight, but ironically, it's Kit who does all the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's good at showing that Constantine Tyne is well known.
Yeah.
Like, this kid who's messing around with Cheryl knows who he is.
Yeah.
He has a rep amongst certain people.
And also the effect that he has. He's knocking about and messing around with all this magic. What effects that going to have?
Yeah.
I also love Steve Dillon isn't as clean as he'll become yet. I absolutely have such a soft spot for early, scratchy Steve Dillon. Especially the way he draws John with his shaggy hair and his gruff, grisly face. It's great.
But you've also got the thing that he's evolved as well.
Yeah.
This is not the Steve Dillon who drew the issues a couple of pages ago.
Yeah.
He's evolved into a different Steve Dillon as well. Issue 63 is John's 40th birthday. Has a great cover by Glenn Fabre, and he's basically just a hijinks issue.
Great issue. Sometimes you need a little hijinks issue.
Yeah, you do. You need to have that comedic interlude.
And I laughed out loud when he pissed on the stranger's shoes.
Yeah, but wouldn't he use that gag again in Hitman?
Probably
doesn't
yeah.
one of them throw up on Green Lantern? Oh, Batman! Yeah. I was going to say Green Lantern.
And the thing is, this as well. One of the big tropes running throughout all of Hellblazer is that John gets all of his mates killed, and it's little issues like this that just remind you that John still has mates, though.
Yeah,
these people care enough about him to show up
for his 40th birthday, including Zatanna.
Yeah,
Zatanna shows up. She doesn't do very much.
They were on and off again, weren't they?
Swamp Thing shows up and grows them a marijuana plant.
This also felt like a little nice epilogue to the Swamp Thing stuff.
I'm sorry. I'm marvelling that they got away with that.
We're Vertigo now, baby.
Yeah, but was Paul Levitz not reading it?
I don't know.
Moore has said that about Preacher, hasn't he? Moore has said about Preacher that they got away with so much for so long because Paul Levitz wasn't reading the Vertigo box.
Oh, right, okay.
And any grief that he got, he absorbed.
Right.
And he never mentioned it to Ennis and Dillard.
Right.
Because he honestly, I think he said it in one of the introductions.
Yeah.
That if that had gone to Ennis and Dillard, that no, you need to change this, they'd have stopped doing Preacher.
Right.
And it was one of their best sellers.
Right.
And that's the thing he had in his back pocket.
So Levitz just took the
Levitz gave him any, you can't do that. Stuart absorbed it.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
Went to Karen Berger and said, look, if we change this, we're going to lose one of our best books. And Karen Berger, I'll deal with it. And they kept him away from it until you get to The Boys, where he didn't stay away much any longer. Because everyone forgets The Boys started as a DC book.
Yeah, yeah.
And Levitz wasn't having none of it. So I can only assume he wasn't really paying much attention to... And that's relatable.
Oh,
that he gets home absolutely rat-arsed and Kit's not very impressed
all been there.
Yeah. Anyway, issue 64 through 66, Fear and Loathing, is a three-part story that starts to knock John down so he can get back up again. Ennis has been having everything go well for John for a while now, so here's where it all comes tumbling down. The Archangel Gabriel is part of John's scheme for bringing down Lucifer, and he gets Tali to seduce him, rip out his heart, and present it to John, who will use it later. This, however, brings John into conflict with a powerful neo-Nazi organisation led by Charles Patterson. Patterson is involved with the people who really run the country, and having had enough of John, they order a hit on Kit. Kit escapes but leaves John, and John is forced to watch as the elites once again kill a friend, Dez, but matters get out of control when George, Dez's brother, kills Patterson. This, Fear and Loathing, is grim and grimy and disgusting. And nobody except maybe Kit is an innocent in this story.
This is my favourite story from this whole run.
Yep.
It's peak Ennis doing it. And yep. There's so many great things about it. It's John being a scumbag, but being the less of the scumbags.
Yes.
It's the effect that he has on everything else. And the thing as well is one of the strongest things about it isn't the main plot. It's the themes of race and
Patterson is mob or a racist, misogynistic scum.
Yeah,
they're another one of those people you want to see John do their worst.
But not to dwell on it, because that's not what this show is about, but we've literally just gone through the whole country turning on its head because of racism and misinterpretation.
Yeah.
And reading this now...
And being told to hate the wrong people.
Yeah, this was 30 years ago saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And Ennis does not shy away from saying... Punch a Nazi. Nazi's a bastard. These people are scum, but they live amongst us.
Yeah.
And the people in charge know that they can control and manipulate. And the best thing about it as well is, for me, is that Constantine tries to be sly. Constantine, he's like, oh no, I'll work my way into them so I can control them that way. George is like, no, there is no solving it. There is no talking to these people. You punch the Nazi. That is how you stop the Nazis. Mm-hmm. You stop them.
Yeah.
It's such a great thing, because that's it. Constantine thinks he can work his job. You can't. Scumbags. No, you stop them.
There's some people you that can't be reasoned with and can't be bargained with. And ultimately, this story ends with you needing a shower. Because even John's not an innocent. John brings down an angel here for his own selfish ends.
Yes.
And Ennis's cynical viewpoint can wear thin on occasion. And there is normally an undercurrent of black humour.
Mm.
But reading this at a time when that was happening,
yeah,
you're like, we've not learned a damn thing.
No, it's the biggest shame about this is when he redoes it in Rake at the Gates of Hell.
and doesn't do it as well.
Doesn't do it as well. Because this is just so good. It works on so many levels. And again, it does that thing where John might be messing around with angels and demons, but you look outside and you are seeing this degree of horrific racism. You are seeing this. These are real people and real horrors.
Yes, and that's what makes it work.
Yeah.
Whilst at the same time being incredibly uncomfortable.
And again, this came out 30 years ago and we're reading it as these riots as these or whatever events, they're being called, are happening.
Yeah, as the events of what happened in the summer of 2024 in the UK happened. It's simultaneously the linchpin story of this run.
Yes.
And utterly gripping whilst being the story that will make you hate people.
And it's he kind of does this similar times, and he did it throughout Preacher as well. And it kind of feels like after this, whenever he did it, there was a hint of not being sincere about it.
Yeah, or this drips with sincerity.
The racists were kind of laughable. Like, you remember the meat factory guy in Preacher?
Yeah.
They were the comedy characters. And yes.
He makes them a comedy villain.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, Charlie Patterson is...
a bloke at the top of a company.
And sometimes racism was a smiling face and drinks a pint and pretends to be your mate down the pub.
Yeah, yeah.
So in having thoroughly depressed you all, it's only going to get worse as we go along, because issue 67, Dear John, depicts the breakup of Kit and John and sees him start to wallow in depression and self-pity and the bottle, and he even falls out with Chaz. And you know what? He deserves it.
He does. It's, again, this works as an epilogue to
Fear and Loathing.
To Fear and Loathing, even though it's kind of on its own. John is a scumbag, and again, what happens when he doesn't get his own way? He broke his promise with Kit. Kit has now left.
Yeah.
And he's just this spiral, this self-destructed spiral. And that's what he is, and he knows that that's what it is, but this is him when that self-awareness runs off.
Yeah.
He is just on this self-destructive spiral, and everyone in his life has said, no, I've had enough. Kit's gone. Chaz leaves him.
Yeah.
This is what happens when John Constantine is let loose. He just will ruin everything, including himself.
Yeah. 68 and 69 are a two-part story in which the king of the vampires, Darius, a piss-taker interview with the vampire characters if ever I've seen one, sees John down on his luck and living on the streets and goes about taking his revenge only to have it turn to ashes in his mouth when John's demon blood burns his throat, giving John time to drag him into the sunlight and kill him. Let's give it up to Ennis for calling issue 69 Rough Trade. In a story that tackles homelessness and alcoholism and redeems vampires as being the grimy little Anne Rice wannabes they are, rather than honourable or likeable or glowy. Equally as gross as Fear and Loathing, there's a moment of joy here when John realises what Darius has done, but he slips back into depression immediately after. This redeems issue 50.
Yeah.
I thought this was another gripping, grimy horror masterwork.
And there's so many lovely little bits. It humanises homeless people, which is just something that, you know, we all see every day and just overlook. These are, again, real people with real stories. And also the strongest thing about this is the line of dialogue. The best thing about being at rock bottom is you can't go any lower.
Yeah.
It's such a great, a profoundly great line of dialogue that just carries so much weight of this story. That's what it is.
As you've pointed out before, this is Dylan scratchy best.
Yeah.
Like, John's face when he burns Darius
is
just as demonic as anything you've seen on any of his foes.
Yeah.
I'm loving the beard and the crusty overcoat that he's wearing and the scruffy hair and that he's willing to do anything for a drink. Vertigo Jam issue 1 features a lovely little short story, Tainted Love, which sees John tell another homeless man a dark tale of jealousy, toxic masculinity, before that was even a thing, and demon worship that ends badly for everyone, even John, who told this story just for a glass of whiskey. Really good one shot, that.
It's good. It's Vertigo Jam as well, which is kind of nice because it's supposed to introduce those characters.
Yep.
And I've got it. And I think this is one of the strongest ones. And despite it so being so set within the story, it's again, another really nice introduction to this character.
What else was in that Vertigo Jam?
There was an issue...
because I must have read it. If you've got it, I must have had it.
Yeah, there's a Kid Eternity.
Right.
There's a Sandman. There's a... Pollack Doom Patrol.
Right.
There's a Swamp Thing. Yeah, I can't think of anything else. If there is anything else,
I don't remember any of them, so they can't have been memorable.
The Sam, yeah, I remember the Samurai one because it's collected in the Absolutes, and it's basically just the, what was the librarian called?
Oh, the ones from House of Secrets.
Is he in that as well?
I think so.
I know Cain and Abel are in House of Secrets.
I know what you mean.
But he's basically just going, oh, you're in a dream. Welcome to Dream. These are the characters.
Right. Okay, okay. Fair enough. Issue 70, Heartland, is a decidedly off-model issue that doesn't feature any magic, or even John Constantine. Rather, it's a pretty straightforward kitchen sink drama about a bunch of friends in Ireland sharing the trials and tribulations and funny stories. It's Friends if Garth Ennis had written it.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I love this issue and I love this cast of characters. I love Heartland. Mm. And obviously this...
It's interesting that he would do the one shot, which is basically the same thing, and call it the same thing.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's so left field. It's got no... It's the ramifications of John Constantine without featuring John Constantine. But yeah, even despite that, I don't know. I just love this cast of characters, and I think this issue just really works well. And again, Ennis is great with characters. These are characters who have no overall impact on the story in and of itself, and you're only ever going to see them once again. Mm. But he nails them down, and he just gets it. This is just day-to-day, mundane character drama.
Yeah, and it's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing wrong with an off-concept issue every now and again.
And then we get to the next issue, which is just glorious.
Issue 71, one of the best issues of the run.
Yep.
Finest Hour. It is amazing in retrospect it took Ennis this long to write a story about an everyday soldier from World War II.
It took him so long to do a war story.
Let's tick another Ennis box, because they're all being ticked. Being here makes it feel present and correct. And it's just, after so many issues of dark cynicism...
Yep.
It's a lovely little story, and it's life-affirming. It may be my favourite issue of the run, and I think when we did our creator spotlights years ago, and we picked a Garth Ennis to do a Garth Ennis episode, I think I picked this issue, didn't I?
Yeah. Well, it works on multiple... It's that life-affirming thing, and it's also contextually in this, it gives John this springboard into it as well. And like you said, it's just this breath of fresh air and just feeling like you've kind of woken up from this dreary... Yeah.
John stumbles upon the still restless spirit of a young World War II fighter pilot who crashed his Spitfire in the war. Unable to rest, John experiences his last few hours of life and realises that's what it is. Life is to live. And having experienced the life of a guy who was only 21, who knew he was going to die, but was determined to not do, even though it was largely out of his control, he pulls himself out of his self-pitying whining and he helps lay the spirit of the pilot to rest.
Yeah.
And it is just a lovely, lovely story. And I love the bit at the end where nowadays he wouldn't even have to do this. He'd just ask him for his debit card, wouldn't he? Yeah. And you can swipe it without anything. But yeah, he buys himself some new clothes. And how much does he give him? I thought this was funny. He gives him the card with his number, and there's at least 50 or 60 pounds in there. 50 or 60 quid...
would not buy him a full suit.
...was enough to buy him a haircut, a full new suit of clothes, and rent a room for the night.
Yeah.
And knowing John, probably buy him a pint.
Yeah.
60 quid?
Yeah, I know.
You're looking at 80 just for the suit, and that's at Asda. So, you know, but no, Finest Hour... Fine, it is.
Yeah.
It's probably the book's finest hour.
It's just a nice message, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
The your cards may be dealt for you, but you don't quit.
Yeah. Because another hand is coming.
Yeah.
So, the Hellblazer special, Confessional, is presented here, but it actually saw print in between Fear and Loathing and the Vampire arcs.
Oh, did it?
But John isn't down and out here.
Because, yeah, no,
So they've resequenced it at this point.
Because I think this is where I have it.
I think that's where I've put it,
right?
Because I think it's the only logical place it can go.
Yeah, because I know they were advertising it around the last few issues or so. Yeah.
One of the best of the run. It's hit this midpoint where every issue is a banger. It's a killer little piece of horror made all the more horrific again by the monster being a regular man.
Yeah.
Give me demons, monsters and the forces of darkness any day.
In fact, I think I messaged you when I was reading this. The bit where the...
So you messaged me when you... And I just read it as well. Yeah. By pure coincidence, we read the same issue at the same time.
There's just something about the sequence where John is in that car and the guy is just talking to him, and the dialogue and the art with the facial expressions is scarier than anything we've seen in this, because it's just people. It's just a conversation, and it's the implication of when things don't go your way. And... Well, it's the implication of what can happen if, you know, it's... I think we all kind of, like... I mean, there was one time where very, very early I was walking into town and this bloke came up to me and is asking me all sorts of these questions, like, what school do you go to? How old are you? Da-da-da-da-da. It's like, where are you off to? Going to meet a mate. Right, see ya, bye. It's ran off. And it's one of those things that... This reminded me of that moment, because it's one of those things, if something... ever so slightly
goes
off.
If you've not been
off,
smart enough to say somebody's expecting me.
Yeah, and that's what makes this so scary, is not only is that an experience that I've gone through, that's an experience that so many people have gone through and can so very easily go so very wrong.
Yeah.
It's the scariest thing in this whole run.
Yes. I mean, the bit where he's going to go down him and then he knees him in the chin.
Yeah.
And the razor blade just slices all up his face.
Just seeing John cry. He's not the same person that never loses. He's accepted that this is going to happen to him. Mm-hmm. And it's only his literal knee-jerk reaction that saves him.
Yeah. And then, obviously, the ending is very bittersweet. I mean, he gets his revenge, but, you know... It's one of the most horrific of the run, for being, like you say, that the main bad guy is this... He's a Catholic priest, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know...
And again, it's that conviction that what he's doing is the right thing. He's doing absolutely horrific acts to innocent people under the conviction that this is the correct thing to do.
Yeah.
And Ennis ties it all in. He's being influenced by the devil, and the devil's got this kind of long game against Constantine, but just in and of itself, it's just this terrifying story of a man who does the wrong things under the belief that it's the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. Issue 72 through 75 is Damnation's Flame, a rare misfire. This run of absolutely top-notch, grade A, top flight, take no prisoners classics comes slightly crashing to the ground.
Yeah.
I didn't know what Ennis was getting at with this one. And it borders on pretentious in places, something he's normally very, very good at avoiding. And it also features a storytelling trope that just bores me rigid. The Vision Quest.
Yeah.
Anytime this comes up in anything, I'm just like, I'm done. I'm bored.
It's just so out of place, isn't it? Because we just grind the story now to it. We've just got this new lease of life, literally. We're back up, you know, we're back running again, and it just grinds right back down just to do... some kind of commentary on the manipulation and corruption of American icons.
Yeah, and it's... The basic story is he goes to New York to leave Kit and London behind for a while, 6 months of slobbing around, have dulled his edges, and Papa Midnight takes him on a hallucinated jaunt through the heart of America. I didn't really get what he was going for. Like you say, there's this whole talk about Americana and American idols, and maybe you shouldn't idolise these people or that person or whatever. Ultimately, other than having a few really funny bits, the opening is brilliant.
The real ale guy on the plane is great.
And him sending that letter to Nigel is absolutely brilliant. And him reading the thing where it says, have you ever involved in these practices, Satanism, Spiritism, Damnation, Divin? And John's like, yeah, like I'm going to say yes.
Well, it pays off because Nigel
mentions that in a later issue. And it's a wonderful little gag because he doesn't signpost it. When you get to the later issue, you go, John wrote that letter. So that was actually really good.
It's a really good setup, this first issue of him meeting the guy in the bar and all that kind of thing. It's really good setup. It's just a shame that we meander around just for the
ultimate.
That's
the word, yeah.
It's just meanders. And ultimately, the point of this is John gets his edge back.
Yeah.
You can do that in one issue, two tops.
You don't have to send him to America for it.
Yeah.
I didn't get why. Because he's not like he's a foreigner offering commentary in a way that foreigners can, because they've got a detached eye.
Yeah.
They have to have some experience with it. So an American who's lived in England can have decent observations about it because he's lived here and was able to point out your foibles. Yeah. John's not really been to America that much.
And it's not like John is making any commentary on it either. No. John goes out of his way to not get involved. This is he's passive.
Yeah. It was served, issue 75 was a double-sized issue. And there was a backup strip depicting John's first meeting with an 18-year-old Kit when she was dating Brendan.
Yeah.
It's served by this.
Yeah, and I think it's very telling that this happens now because we bring Brendan back. So it's that kind of reminder of this character's going to come up. It's been a while since we last saw him. Here's a little reminder.
And it's also Will Simpson back on art for this little backup.
Yeah.
And he kind of redeems himself.
Mm.
The art in this little backup is lovely.
Yeah.
And the colours are nice as well. So he's not been ruined by the colourist. But yeah, most of all, that meander's the best word for it.
It's such a shame as well, because I think that with the special, that is the apex of this run. From now on, we are very steadily declining.
It's plateaued at this point,
yeah. And it's, let's say it's without his moments, because this next issue is, it's again, great. Is another highlight. And again, it does what Ennis does best.
Yep.
It brings back your Irish character that Ennis can talk through.
Irish tick.
In this drinking story.
Tick. Americana tick.
In this story.
The Pogues tick.
About friendship and drinking.
Yeah.
And all it is essentially
drinking tick.
Is just Ennis waxing lyrical about what it means to be Irish and all these different things. And he's so contradictory. This character is essentially, Brendan is just chatting shit.
Yes.
And that's pointed out. And John doesn't even listen to him after a certain point. But again, it's just so well constructed and so well written. And these characters are so lovable that, again, it's just this really nice issue.
Yes.
I love that even though Brendan's a ghost, he can still drink. But there's even a line where it's like, oh, I'm going to go get some food. Do you want anything? I'm a ghost. I can't eat. You can still drink, though.
Yeah, which because that's his heaven.
No one questions that John is always buying 2 pints. It's like he is literally there. The ghost is visible.
Yeah. Well, you've preempted that that was issue 76. Yeah. Confessions of an Irish Rebel. It is, yeah. It's a great send-off for Brendan Finn. John meets up with his ghost when his flight back from New York stops over at Dublin. It is just a fun character piece. But it's almost a book of cliches, and it's cliches, isn't it? It's focus on Ireland, drinking, male friendship, more drinking, Constantine being a ruin to everyone who comes into contact with him, police brutality, and more drinking.
Yeah.
So it is, but it's fun, and there's another Ennis trope in this, ever so slightly, but this plays more into Preacher.
Yeah.
This idea of people not being able to let go.
Right.
That they'll move somewhere, but they'll take their baggage with them.
Okay, yeah.
Like, you're still angry over something that happened 200 years ago.
Yeah.
You weren't even there for it. Yeah. You've moved over to get away from it, to live somewhere else, but you're still carrying that baggage. That's more a Preacher thing.
Yeah.
But it is here. When he says, you've still got a chip on your shoulder, friggin' Field of Spuds, more like. That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Let things go.
Yeah.
But apparently people can't, you know? So,
you know, I don't think I mentioned this before when Steve Dillon came on board. And I don't know if it's something you noticed because there's no focus on it. He's very, very particular with his continuity on pints and cigarettes.
Oh, is he?
With each panel, right. the fags will go down more. The pints will go down more. John lights up another cig when he's just finished his last one. And it's a neat little touch that Dylan does quite a lot.
No, I had not noticed that. But that's like the kind of background detail that you don't notice until it's pointed out.
And then when you've noticed, you notice it.
Yeah, that he's spot on with his continuity. Issue 77, And the Crowd Goes Wild, is a one-off tale with art by Peter Schnesberg. Down the pub, Chaz tells his friends fanciful tales of John, which leads to a reconciliation between the two of them. It's good.
Yeah.
You know, it's John, Ennis, putting all the ducks back in a row for leaving the book in such a way that whoever comes along next can just pick up and run with it. That's basically what he's doing.
Touches nicely on the kind of, everyone knows who John is, but everyone's depiction of him is different. It's a nice little thing.
Yeah. We've seen that kind of Rocherman type tale before. It's not how I remember it, but whatever. Issue 78 through issue 83 is The Rake at the Gates of Hell and is the 6-part conclusion, essentially, to Ennis's run. It all comes home to roost for John when Lucifer makes his play. Pretty much everyone from the Ennis run dies in this story as Ennis basically resets back to status quo for whoever follows him. Less a gestalt, more a set of six loosely connected stories. It's an ending that is simultaneously disappointing, yet apt. Hellblazer's horror has never really been of the fire and brimstone variety, more a quiet and disturbing, uneasy horror rather than terrifying. Some of the deaths hit hard, some feel perfunctory and others inevitable. Kudos to Ennis for not killing Kit and giving her and John a proper resolution before the finale, which is inevitable. But Ennis actually cops to it being an anticlimax in the dialogue, but that's Hellblazer.
Yeah, this felt like more of a miss to me because it's not a payoff. A lot of it is just perfunctory. We've got his mates dying, even off page.
Yeah.
Just because they have to.
Yeah.
They're his side characters. And it's just the big narrative beat that was running through all of this is how is the devil going to get payback? He does it just because he decides that now is the time to do it. He's like, oh, I've just realised now how I can solve my problems.
Yeah.
There's no payoff. It just happens. We bring back the race stuff to a lesser degree. It doesn't work as well. It's just backdrop.
I mean, he does save a life.
Yeah.
Which is rare.
But again, there's been a time jump in between issues, and John now has a new girlfriend who is completely unimportant, only to remind us that John is a scumbag.
I didn't get that. I didn't get why she was... She's there because the story needs a nurse.
And because it needs someone to tell John that he's a scumbag
again. Yeah, it's one of those old episodes of a TV show where the character's got this girlfriend that we've never seen before, who he loves dearly, and he's thinking of quitting whatever the job is in the show to be with this girl, so she has to die.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, Don Johnson marrying Sheena Easton in Miami Vice.
Right.
You know at some point she's going to die, because otherwise the show's over.
Yeah.
And it's the same with this. I needed the character to be able to have access to a doctor.
Yeah.
So the easiest way to do that is give John a girlfriend who's a nurse.
Yeah.
And it felt a little bit...
It's clunky.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with it is, because the last few issues have just been a meandering grind, that by the time we get to this payoff, it doesn't work and there's no... It's not satisfying.
Yeah.
Maybe it shouldn't be. You know, I think we're looking at this as a singular story, but it's not. It's just a run of a 300-issue series.
Yeah.
There is no beginning, middle, and end. This is just a new writer and a new artist taking over a tapestry. So there's that. You've got to contextualise it, but at the same time, this is called Hellblazer by Garth Ennis.
Yeah, there's an issue 84.
Yeah, so even going into it as an omnibus, this is why I was kind of interested to see how it reads now, because going into this is a self-contained story.
Mm.
So you expect a beginning and a middle and end, but it's not. It's a 300-issue tapestry, so can you be satisfying with your ending when it's not an ending?
Yeah. Yeah, I get what... It's not an unsatisfying resolution.
Yeah.
You're right, it isn't an ending. Because like we just said, there is a next issue.
Yeah.
But I didn't think it was as... That middle chunk...
Yeah.
...is superlative.
Yeah.
And then he never... The America arc... kills the momentum.
Definitely, yeah.
So then he never recovers.
To go into the finale after that,
yeah,
is just shot himself in the foot a bit.
Yes, he's lost that momentum of each issue being better than the last.
Yeah.
And suddenly you're just like, oh.
Which okay. I wonder why. I wonder what was going on or what he'd read or seen that provoked that, because it has such an effect on the narrative as a whole.
Yeah.
But he spent 5-6 issues and an anniversary issue on it, so there must have been some reason.
Something in the air at that time. And well, Kennedy was big at the minute. JFK had just come out.
Right.
It was an anniversary of his death or something.
He was
very much in the zeitgeist,
right,
to be pretentious,
yeah,
at that time. And I think there was a couple of different JFK movies, weren't there?
Right.
And there's an episode of Quantum Leap.
Okay,
where Sam Beckett leaps into Lee Harvey Oswald. So it was very definitely in the air at that moment in time.
Right.
When you read it now, there is a... And I've asked American friends about this. What is your fascination with JFK?
Yeah.
And now you read it and I'm like... Well, and again, that may play a part of it.
Mm.
We don't get that. I don't understand what that fascination is.
Isn't it along the lines of he was such an idealized president who... finished before his time.
Possibly.
Isn't there an argument like he represents the death of America as it was to an extent?
That seems to be what Ennis is saying.
Yeah.
But in terms of reading this now 30 years later,
yeah,
you're left just going, oh, what was all that about? So there is a problem between being of the moment in your storytelling when 30 years later that of the moment doesn't exist anymore.
Well, maybe there was no... Obviously, back then, he wasn't thinking this is going to be reprinted as a big hardback. So maybe it was just a case of, for him, this was just a monthly thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. All Those Little Girls and Boys is a short story from Vertigo Winter's Edge 2. I found it a bit pointless.
I didn't read it because I don't know if I've got it.
You should have read it before we started recording.
I don't know. I forgot that he was in it, but yeah.
John basically muses on what his friends were like as kids.
All right.
Because they've let this kid in a pub.
Right.
And John's like, why are they letting kids in pubs?
Right.
But that was the start of this.
Yeah.
Of starting to let kids in pubs. I think it ruined pubs. But that's just me. Heartland was a one-shot.
Interesting, your cover's different. Oh, the cover that's collected here is
different. Yeah, that's not your cover, is it?
No.
A one-shot by Ennis and Dillon. It has no John, again, no supernatural, no horror elements at all, other than those we visit upon ourselves. Dillon's art is really different here. Not worse or better, but different.
Well, this was peak Preacher when this came out, I think.
So there's a substantial gap then,
based
isn't there?
On the Vertigo Over the Ledge previews of what was coming out this month, we had just gone to Salvation.
Right. So the problem with that is you're not now seeing an evolution of art.
Yeah.
You're seeing a massive gap
in
art. And yes, his art here is technically better than anything we've seen previously.
Technically, yeah.
But very different.
Yeah.
While still being the same guy.
Yeah.
So it was interesting from that point of view. Basically, Kit's gone back to Ireland. And it's another kitchen sink drama. Ennis's pet tropes, people being people wherever they are or wherever they're from. Ennis seems to believe most people can get along quite happily if governments and forces beyond our control didn't keep screwing us over.
Yeah.
We're all facile and deep, loving and loathsome, happy and sad. It's not one I'd revisit often, but I'm glad it exists.
I love this one shot, and I think it's this perfect distillation of everything that he was saying throughout Hellblazer. John's presence is felt over this, despite not being mentioned or featured
in it
whatsoever.
And 90% of the cast not knowing who he is.
Yep. But this idea, and he does such a great job. And this is why Kit left. She mentions it, but this is it. And he uses this backstory of this abusive household, but a wife who stays with her husband because she has to for her kids, and the kids just get used to it, and how you see that against the troubles.
Mm.
We see a British person go to Ireland and go, how are you used to these soldiers? How are you used to the guns? How are you used to the bombs? How have you adapted to just, this is mundane? And he does such a really good job of taking all the bitterness and resentfulness and the bad, but show the good in it, and to say why you put up with it, who you put up with these things for. And it's just this perfect distillation of everything. Kit left because she didn't want to do this. She didn't want to stick with this cycle. But we're seeing her as not this manic pixie dream girl. She is also flawed because she's just a person. And like Rake at the Gates of Hell before, it doesn't end. It carries on.
Yeah.
These characters go off to the pub every other night after we finish reading this. It's this kitchen sink mundane look on just a snapshot of people's lives, and I genuinely think this is one of my favourite things to come out of this run. I love it so much.
One of the best things Ennis has written?
Potentially. Yeah. Overlooked, underrated, but just worth the read in and of itself. Oh, it's separate from Hellblazer.
Yeah.
The only thing with it is it's such a good epilogue that if Ennis were to ever come back to these characters, it might, you know, not be as good.
I don't think that's likely. And we'll talk about that in the epilogue.
And then, you know, as we're going to cover here.
Yeah. Ennis and Dillon left to create what many, including myself, still feel is their magnum opus, Preacher. Preacher is still the Ennis Dillon book I recall fondly, and it's a story featuring many of the elements Ennis touched upon in Hellblazer, such as friendship, male bonding and masculinity, about 15 years before everyone else jumped on that bandwagon, but Preacher does it better. The lure of John was always there, though, and 4 years later he returned with Son of Man, originally running in Hellblazer 129 through 133, with art by John Higgins.
Yeah.
It's an odd duck of a story. John's past comes back to haunt him, again, when a demon he summoned a while back, again, threatens to deliver hell upon earth, again. This time, John resurrected the son of a London gangster after the son was killed in an accident. The resurrection was accomplished by John placing the demon in the lad. 21 years later, the demon is looking to spawn. It's basically Ennis on autopilot, to be honest. There's some laughs to be found, but it's almost too grim, with dead babies and rape thrown into the mix, plus some dubious sexual politics, all played for laughs. It's one of the rare times Ennis's black humour and horror doesn't work. This should either have been an out-and-out comedy, which it almost is, or an out-and-out horror, which it almost is, but by the time it turns into Alien, I was glad that it was coming to an end. Ennis also has John breaking the fourth wall throughout the story, like a demented John Krasinski, and this starts to get really irritating. It's a trope that you can overcook, and this burns it.
Yeah, well, I didn't mind the talking to the audience. It's John always narrated to the audience anyway. This is just an extension of that. I didn't mind that. The thing with is, this is when it very much feels like just six issues of that 300-page tapestry.
Yeah.
And so reading this after finishing off the run and reading Heartland, it felt like this watered-down return that didn't work for me. We briefly see some of the old side characters.
Chaz.
And there's an almost touching sequence where John is at the bar with Heather, Rick, and Brendan, and then they're not there anymore.
Yeah.
It's almost sweet for that couple of panels, but it's just this poor comedy that, delves in, takes these horrific things, but laughs at them. And then the ultimate payoff is that the monster is this giant dicked rape monster. It's just not good.
No.
It's too horrific to be a comedy, but too comedic to be a horror. It's just not... Again, like you said, this is Ennis at autopilot.
Yeah.
And it's not so bad that it's bad.
Nope.
But reading this after having read what he is capable of doing with these characters, this is just a little revisit that maybe he shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, shouldn't have been collected in this omnibus. But then you'd have completionists complaining, but this suffers more
It suffers from comparison.
Being next to it.
Yeah. Don't disagree with you at all. I think there's some heartfelt moments. But this goes to what you mentioned earlier on. The gangsters here are cockney cliches.
Yeah.
There isn't a believable bad guy there.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're all just boring.
And they were almost kind of entertaining. There was something about the stereotypical dialogue that if this was just a story about John going up against some, you know, cockney mafia bad guys, might have been funny, but it's everything else thrown into the mix that's just, again, you know, like you said, by the time it comes to its typical finale, you're like, good, I am glad
I'm done with this now. John and Chaz felt out of character as well. Yeah. They felt very cockney, like Terry and Arthur of the horror set.
Yeah.
And it's all a bit Guy Ritchie.
And it's funny because not enough time has happened in between these issues. There's only a handful of years in between him leaving and then coming back.
Well, he left with issue 80-something, and this was issue 129.
Yeah, so I suppose even then, that's about 4 or 5 years or so.
But in that interim, it's kind of like, has he forgotten how to write him?
Probably.
Yeah.
Was there a reason why he came back for it? Is he said anywhere? Or just for money?
Yeah, it may have been just come back and do a 5-issue arc to separate writers.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know, because Ellis, this comes right in the middle of Warren Ellis.
Does it?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I don't know. Was it the time Ellis was having trouble and he got that issue pulled and was never printed until many years later? So
Warren
Ellis may have been walking away and they needed to quit. I don't know.
Because was that when Columbine happened? That's what pulled it?
Yes.
Right, so I wonder when that fell.
Don't know. We'd have to have... Yeah. If we were professional, we would have looked it up. The omnibus concludes with the various different covers that have been done for the trade paperback collections and some posters that probably
from issue 50.
Appeared in issue 50, yeah. Reading this now, it hits significantly differently than reading it when it came out. For one, times change and people change with them. What it was once the work of an edgy 20-something can come across sometimes as whiny and pretentious. Ennis stays just over the line, though. Although John is very much written as someone with a case of arrested development. He's not written as a mature 40-something.
No.
In these stories. He's very much an early 20s wanker. He's all socialist posturing, sloganeering, without actually offering solutions to any of the problems as he perceives them. Speaking of problems, he never confronts them as an adult. He runs away from them all the time. Kit's right to leave him.
Yeah.
And every one of his friends, relatives, he's right to warn them away. That said, when the stories are good, they are very, very good. And a lot of the horror elements still land. It's just interesting that I don't view John as a protagonist anymore. Someone worthy of note. Rather, he's someone I wouldn't want anything to do with.
See, you're right, and I completely agree with you, but that is what I like about him. Mm. If we're comparing it to Preacher, which we've done several times, when I first read Preacher when I was 14 or whatever old, that was this kind of moment where it was like, that is who I want to be. I want to be Jesse Custer when I grow up. Mm. And for better and for worse, I spent most of my teenage years trying to be Jesse Custer. Whereas John Constantine is this endearing character. He's one of my favourite characters because he's that bad guy. He's, you know, we've mentioned before that some of our favourite characters are those complex, they're bad, but they're not as bad as them type characters. And John is almost as bad as them, but not quite. He's this complex character who's this whiny asshole you don't want to hang out with. He ruins everything, and that just makes it like you want to just know him more. Mm. He's like, he literally is the car crash that you can't look away from. And if you get to know him, you are going to be in that car with him. And that just, I think that's why people like him. That's why he lasted 300 issues and would have lasted longer if it weren't for the New 52.
He would have carried
on. We know we don't like him. We know he's a bad guy. And that's just why he's charming enough that he keeps us with him for as long as we have been.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, Ennis also has matured over the years, very definitely. We covered Battle Action.
Yes.
That is very much the stories that he couldn't have written here. He wasn't old enough, he wasn't mature enough. And he said he no longer admires the character of John Constantine. I found an interview on Vulture where he said, I've known a few too many lovable rogues, wide boy types in real life to find the notion attractive. People who abuse their friends, disappear for a while, then come back and do it all again because they know they'll be forgiven. I've no desire to write a character who essentially just gets his pals killed and then explains that they were doomed anyway, so why not just spend their lives and use them up? So I don't think it's likely he's ever going to go back to Constantine anytime in the future.
Yeah.
And if this means that that is the case, then maybe that's a good thing. His war books tend to be more interesting nowadays, and he certainly seems to prefer writing them. His version of Constantine has never really been adapted. The TV and film versions soften his edges.
Yeah.
However, the most recent season of The Boys sees the writers confuse their Ennis works.
Okay.
In that Billy Butcher bears more than a passing resemblance to the Constantine of Ennis's comics.
Right.
Than the Butcher of The Boys comics.
Yeah.
Not helped by Carl Urban's hammy performance right. And even hammier accent. My God. I like Carl Urban.
Yeah.
I think normally he's really solid. He's brilliant as Judge Dredd.
Right.
He's great in Lord of the Rings. Brilliant in Xena.
Okay, right.
In his early roles in Xena. He is so hammy in The Boys. And I don't know if it's having to do the accent.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is shit. And nobody seems to tell him this.
Yeah.
Is making him, I mean, he makes William Shatner at his hammiest look wooden.
I'll give it a go at some point, because I gave up on The Boys comic well before it
finished. I read all of it.
And it's,
the TV show isn't the comic.
Yeah, and I've heard that, and I've heard that it's very better, but then I've also heard a lot of things that this one's not being as good, and I don't know, I don't have enough skin in the game to say, but
the latest season of The Boys is a prime example of one of those things that, yes, this is why editors exist.
Right.
This is why censors exist.
Right.
People to tell you, you need to pull that back a bit.
Yeah.
Because it's not doing anything for the story.
Yeah.
It's just, you're being gross now for the sake of being gross.
Right.
And it's to the point now with The Boys where it's actively harming the show.
Yeah.
There's bits in it now where you're not grossed out by it anymore. You're just like, can we get on with it, please?
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I get that he's sticking stuff up Huey's arse.
Right.
And this is being played for laughs rather than you're actually raping your lead character.
Yeah.
So can we move on, because your immaturity's showing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that in The Boys now. I did enjoy rereading these.
Yes.
I thoroughly enjoyed texting each other as we were going along and reading each book. At its best, it's sophisticated horror. At its worst, Son of Man, it's sophomoric.
Yeah.
It was everything good and bad about Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a part of me that's glad to have left Constantine behind. I've no interest in the post-Vertigo versions of the character.
Yeah.
Although the hardcover black label book Rise and Fall by Tom Tyler and Derek Robertson was interesting.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I've read.
I've heard that this current run, well, and the run that this current run is a sequel to is good, but it's, for me, John Constantine, he didn't die. That's not how it ended. He did kind of die, but that ended with issue 300. And I read all of those issues. And when Milligan killed it off, that's when it ended. And then I read the Jeff Lemire stuff and the Justice League Dark stuff, and it's a completely different character, and he's this good, heroic Doctor Strange character, and that's not what pulled me to John Constantine. I'm very aware that John Constantine is this awful human being. That's what I enjoy about it. And so that, to me, that Constantine finished.
Yeah.
This isn't the same character. And I've, there's a part of me that wants more of that John Constantine, but there's a part of me that's glad that
it exists as a complete whole.
And it will always be there. Yeah. I can always go back to this character. There is not more of that. So as much as I want to, maybe it's a good thing.
But there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with realising, right, that character is now not for me. Yeah. I add my bit.
Yeah.
And it's still there. And I can revisit him anytime I want to.
Yeah.
But I'm not interested in the new stuff. And that's a better and more healthy approach than constantly bitching that the new stuff isn't what you want. And it's like, dude, you've got yours.
Yeah.
You like that. It was 300 issues. That's a healthy run.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like you got 6 episodes of a TV show and then it was cancelled.
Yeah.
You got 300 issues there. I am not interested.
I think it's only, we're not going to go into this too much, but for me, John Constantine is the perfect representation of one of the biggest shortcomings of DC's approach to the New 52, and that everyone now, I will always defend the New 52, but everyone had to be this young, good-looking, good guy, went out of the way to be right, and so that's who John Constantine became, and that's a misinterpretation of a lot of your characters for the sake of being young.
Yeah, well, times change, people change. It's still a seminal work.
It's still getting reprinted in nice big hardbacks.
Yeah, if you like disturbing horror, it may be right up your street. The less cynical may want to give it a swerve.
Yeah.
But that's Garth Ennis, John Constantine, Hellblazer. Next time, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics, we're going to do Dragon Ball.
We're going to do something completely different.
Yeah.
Something lighthearted, something fun light-hearted, for kids.
Frothy, fun
for
kids. I'm quite looking forward to it.
It's going
to
be...
You loved Dragon Ball as a kid.
Well, I loved Dragon Ball Z.
Right.
And this is... Your
fish were called Goku and Gohan.
They were. this is going to be a pseudo two-parter.
Yeah.
We are going to...
Not two consecutives.
No, it's pseudo.
Yeah.
So we're going to look at the first story arc of Dragon Ball, which takes us all the way up covering the Emperor Pilaf saga, if that means anything to anyone.
Not to me.
It's the first story arc. We're then going to have a break covering something else. We're then going to come back with the first story arc of Dragon Ball Z, which jumps considerably in the future. And that is what most of the world grew up with. That is what we all know to be the beginning.
Right. Well, very much looking forward to that. So we'll see you all next week. Listen to the end tag. You can buy us a coffee like Dan did. Drop us an email, text message like the other Dan did. and we'll see you next time.
Yes.
Goodbye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Hey Kids Comics is a The Devil Will Make Work for Idle Hands to Do production and hosted by Andrew and Michael Leyland. All opinions expressed in the show are the opinions of the hosts and no one else. The free-to-use music that closes and opens the show was the sci-fi cyberpunk trailer by somebody called Stringer Bell on the Pixabay.com free-to-use website. Thank you very much to him. If you would like to support the show, you can buy Michael and I, or both of us, or one of us, a coffee. Go to ko-fi.com, that's ko-fi.com/A-Leyland. In 1 month, an all-new episode of Hey Kids Comics coming in your ears. It's a date.